Well, a very good afternoon to you all, and welcome to this afternoon session. We have a great lineup of speakers, as I'm sure you're all aware, and we're looking forward to learning from you all. So the very first speaker we have this afternoon is Dr. Rebecca Dahlschneider, who will be speaking on prioritizing communication in an undergraduate science program. So without further ado, over to you, Rebecca.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay, so in 2016, I joined Providence. You can see my affiliation up there. Just in case you're not familiar, Providence is a small, rural, Christ-focused institution in southern Manitoba. So I joined there in 2016 with a task to start a science program. It's always fun to have someone who helped hire me in the room. Thanks, Patrick. So in starting the science program and in growing it over the last several years, I did my best to prioritize communication. So I'll tell you a little bit about that today and try to explain why that matters. I'm sure we all know why communication is important, but I thought I would start off with a bit of a review to ensure we're all on the same page. So communication skills are considered a core competency, an important skill. I think the Vision and Change in Undergraduate Biology Education report, a really well-cited report out of the US, explains this really well. They highlight several core competencies in undergraduate biology education that I'm sure many of which transfer into other science disciplines as well. I won't read this whole quote. I'll just highlight and read aloud the bottom part. It reads, practicing the communication of science through a variety of formal and informal written, visual, and oral methods should be a standard part of undergraduate biology education. So it is a core competency for a variety of reasons. The main one because they are so involved in the workplace, in many different scientific careers, and thus it is communication skills are prized by employers. A third reason why communication is important, in my opinion, is that communication skills are important for building trust, which is something that's come up in, I think, a lot of our keynote lectures and sessions, this conference. And I'll come back and expand on this point at the end of my talk. And lastly, a thought that has really captivated me in recent years is that communication skills promote learning. There's a vast scholarship that supports this, and I'll just read the first part of this quote, which I think summarizes that scholarship well. The beginning of this quote reads as this, study after study has shown that students perform better in their courses, and they have a stronger handle on the material they are learning if they have opportunities to write and speak about that material on a regular basis. And so in working towards developing communication skills, students are obviously learning to communicate. And as they communicate, as they write, as they give presentations, as they communicate in other ways, they are learning. They are learning the content they are communicating, as well as learning those communication skills. So perhaps you're familiar with some of the common phrases that highlight that point, that students are learning to write and writing to learn. Or more generally, students learn to communicate and communicate to learn or learn more of their learn more content. And that is another point I will come back to at the end of my presentation as well. So when I started the science program at Providence, I of course wanted to ensure that my students were developing their communication skills. So I asked myself, how do I do this? This is really important. Obviously, consulted colleagues, literature, lots of scholarship. And it seems like there are two main programmatic approaches that I've just numbered one and two on this slide. Number one, there are dedicated communication courses. And number two is a communication across the curriculum approach, often abbreviated as CXC or CAC for short. And it seems like over the years, there's still been debate over these two approaches. And I think the debate is highlighted nicely in this quote from a peer-reviewed scientific article published just last year, so still quite recent. It still perceives an ongoing debate over where to teach communication skills in science degrees and whether it should be with the addition of a dedicated course to teach a single or subset of similar skills, so that would be point number one, or to integrate them into existing courses instead, which is more of a communication across the curriculum approach number two. And these authors are not alone. There are many program developers and professors out there that are asking these sorts of questions. So I will review these two approaches just briefly, and then I'll talk a little bit about how I've put them into place. So we'll start with just a little bit of history. Obviously, there is a long history of dedicated communication courses. The freshman communication courses have been around for at least around 200 years in North America, at least. And at the turn of the 20th century is where we start to see some specialized communication courses, business communication, notably. So we see English composition as a course that has stood the test of time, and others have come up since. Communication across the curriculum, in contrast, is a little bit more of a recent approach. It seems to have began as language across the curriculum in Britain. We see it first published in the literature in 75, but it seems like it had been discussed prior to that. It seemed to be known as writing across the curriculum in the United States, and then expanded to communication across the curriculum well into the 80s. So at that point, communication across the curriculum was not just writing, but oral communication, public speaking. And nowadays, it seems like scholars have expanded that communication category even further to include more visual, audiovisual, technological forms of communication as well. I'm sure you're familiar with what a dedicated communication course looks like. I'm sure we've all taken at least one. So it's very common for every student in an entire institution, or at least every student of a particular major, say all business students take a business communication course. They usually take it early on in their degree, and if not right in their first year. The approach, the communication across the curriculum approach can look quite different. So it can be the philosophy of an educator. It's certainly part of my teaching philosophy. Can be the philosophy of a program. Can also be a philosophy of an entire institution. I've also seen it to be quite common as a part of a center for teaching and learning. Perhaps you come from an institution that perhaps has a director of communication across the curriculum. There are several, especially American institutions, that have positions like that. And so, of course, the format is different. With a dedicated communication course, the entire course is focused on communication studies or the development of particular communication skills. Whereas communication across the curriculum is integrated into a variety of courses in, if not in all disciplines. Of course, a dedicated communication course would be taught by someone well-trained in communication studies or in writing or in communication skills. Whereas communication across the curriculum can be taught by varied faculty members with different histories of training and perhaps with the equipping done by their Center for Teaching and Learning. They can thus integrate communication into their disciplines and into their courses. So too, we can compare some of the benefits here. And so, of course, with a dedicated communication course, because it is dedicated to communication studies, they can achieve great depth. And students have the time to progress towards mastery of an understanding of communication theories or mastery of particular communication skills. In contrast, communication across the curriculum, we see more breadth instead of depth. So students are able to apply their knowledge of communication skills to a variety of different contexts, variety of different issues and problems and situations, and thus gain experience there. So I don't know if in your educational institutions, if you talk about depth versus breadth a lot. I have been in some of those conversations myself, so we see that playing out here as well. Perhaps at this point you see, okay, these two approaches, yes, are different, but they're not mutually exclusive. Certainly a program doesn't have to follow one or two. It can be both. Why not both? You can do one and two. And so certainly that's the philosophy that I took when I was developing the science program at Providence. We have dedicated communication courses, and we've also done our best to integrate communication across our curriculum. Both of these approaches really should give us, or give our students rather, ample opportunities to develop important communication skills. So here on this slide, I put our little Prov logo in the bottom corner there, just so that you can see a little bit about what we do at this institution. And in going through some of these examples, hopefully I can inspire you to think about communication in your program, if you're part of an academic institution, or to just think about communication training of scientists around you and what that means for our communities and our places of worship. So here are some of the dedicated communication courses we offer at Providence. English composition, standard, right? Who has taken that course or works at an institution that has that course? common English composition. We also have a first-year communications and media, which in recent years we've made a required course for every single student in our institution, regardless of major. So students have a good understanding of English language and writing, and a good understanding, at least at the introductory level, of communication theory and develop some media literacy. The third course there falls under the specialized communication category, scientific writing and communication. It's a course that I teach, and every time I teach it, I keep reminding myself, I think this may be one of the most important courses I teach in terms of equipping students with skills that will serve them well in the future. If you're interested about what that course looks like, I've actually printed off a few paper syllabi. Didn't want to damage too many trees, so I just have a few copies here. Feel free to email me and we can discuss further if you have comments or questions about that course. I also wanted to list a few of the ways that we integrate communication across our curriculum. So you see a variety of activities and assessments and assignments and communication things that we do with our science students. Lab reports, papers, presentations, those are pretty standard. I'll go through a few of the examples at the bottom here, just because I think technology and some of the newer innovations in education are really helping us to do some of these things really well. So I'll go from annotations all the way down to creative projects and just show you some examples along the way and hopefully inspire you or at least bring up some questions for discussion after. So annotations, I'm sure we're familiar with that concept, right? You assign students a reading, some papers, maybe some primary peer-reviewed scientific literature, and ask them to annotate, highlight, summarize, question, synthesize, things like that. I assigned some annotations in some of my courses, but with the start of the COVID-19, the pandemic, I actually did more because there's a lot of wonderful online programs that make it easy to do so online. Does anyone use Perusal in the audience? Yeah, it's a fantastic program. Hypothesis is similar, and there are some other online social annotation tools that make assignments like this easy. And so you upload any type of document you wish your students to read. You can see a peer-reviewed article that I've selected and assigned to my students there. They highlight different parts, images, text. They can highlight anything they want, and then they talk about it. They communicate, and they discuss with one another in an online asynchronous platform that easily can integrate into a variety of learning management systems. Students like it because it's online, asynchronous, great for community building in an online setting. And I love it because it's very automated and it makes grading and record keeping just really quite seamless. One of the things I love to do with my annotations is to really think quite purposefully about selecting diverse sources. Diversity and inclusion is obviously big topics in education. And so you see a few of my cancer biology readings there. My fourth year cancer biology students read a lot more than this, but these are just the three articles I asked them to annotate. And I think for here, it was just really important for me to try my best to achieve a balance within the authors. You don't see the authors there, but students would when they click on these titles and see the full text and list of authors. For the sake of time, I won't go into why that's particularly important to me, but feel free to ask a question about that in the Q&A if you like. I'll see that thought with you. Here you just see some of the annotations or the readings that my students annotated my fourth year pharmacology course. Here, it's a wonderful list of stories about very famous drug discoveries and just the joy of inquiry. Here, my goal is to help my students develop more of a global perspective. So one of these papers is authored by scholars in India, another authored from scholars in Switzerland, another from a very famous pharmacologist in Japan, as well as many authors from North America. So I think annotations, and online annotations especially, allow us to really think about the resources that we're curating and assigning to our students and the perspectives that we are guiding them to. So another assignment example that I wanted to highlight here are discussions. Discussions, again, very standard, but I think there are ways that we can modify our discussions to really help our students not only develop oral communication skills and critical thinking that they would do in a typical discussion, but also think about communication outside of the classroom, which is really a fantastic goal as well. So I love to end an in-person or online discussion with some of the prompts that I put here. I sometimes ask my students, how would you explain this topic to a family member? What are the key points you would share with a friend? And how would you share this information on social media? If you see these thoughts and get your students talking about it, it's been my experience that they will actually give it a try. They may talk to some of their family members and their friends and their social contacts. And it's just a fantastic way for them to share what they're learning, then learn more, and then to also just put more science out there into our everyday conversations. The last point speaks about social media, and sometimes I get my students to make social media posts as assignments. Does anyone else do that here? Maybe, okay, couple. So our institution actually has our own app, which makes this quite easy, so I don't have to follow students and manage other social media platforms. So here you just see the start of one of our social media assignments in my third year immunology course. Aren't my giant microbes cute, right? That's attention grabbing. And so you see here that I kind of start off and acknowledge that over the next 6 Mondays, this was back in 2019, my immunology students developed posts about immunology that they got really excited about and that they thought our student body would also be interested in. Here you see a bit of a different social media post. So sometimes I'll give students an assignment, low stakes, maybe 1% of their grade, where they have to make a post about something that they've learned in class that they want to share with the community. Sometimes they even make this as a bonus assignment. And it's really fantastic to see students translate their knowledge outside of the classroom and to see some other students on campus, non-science students even, comment and ask questions and just have some good discussion with our community that way. Exams are something that are still quite common. I do my best to switch up my assignment and assessment practices as much as I can and use alternative methods when appropriate. But let's face it, I still have exams in some of my courses. I think there are ways that we can make use of exam questions to help our students develop communication skills, not just in a typical exam writing way, but in a knowledge translation, getting knowledge outside of the classroom as well. So in my third year immunology and fourth year pharmacology class, I ask questions like this. So I'll read this one aloud. The question reads like this. You have some friends who heard you are taking this great pharmacology course. I think it's great. They have a bunch of good questions. Respond to 10 of the 15 friends using words that are easy for these non-scientists to understand. 1 point per answer. And so I didn't put all 15 there. I just put a handful of you for you to just get the gist. Ray asks, why would my mother's doctor prescribe her raloxifene? G asks, are vaccines tested in clinical trials? Io asks, why would anyone take nitroglycerin? I thought that was explosive. Lou asks, my pharmacist told me to avoid grapefruit while taking this drug. Why? And so on. And so my students have told me that they've really enjoyed answering this exam question, which is a great response. Usually exams don't elicit joy. But this is a fun way for students to think about what their knowledge means and how they can actually make use of that in their everyday conversations and participate in some science communication. Hopefully you also see a little bit of my commitment to diversity and inclusion here. I try to choose names that reflect the diversity of my student body. So my students don't all have names like Anne and John, so I try to choose names that we would hear around the world that mean something to our students. So my last two examples that I want to highlight are a little bit more creative. One is a blog that we just started recently. So my third year human disease course is a required course for health science majors. We started this blog called What Killed Stanley. I built it on WordPress. I don't know if I regret it, but Substack does seem to be a little bit better in some regards. And anyways, it's just a really fun way for students to think about the knowledge of human disease that they're developing and put it out into the world. And then they can easily share the blog post they wrote with their friends, with their family, with their church pastor, with whoever they think would be interested, and thus help to share the knowledge they've gained and communicate. The podcast that we've developed is similar. This is an assignment for my upper level capstone topics in health research course. We've named our blog, Who Cares, So What? Science at Providence Podcast. You can record these episodes really easily using Anchor and make them available on Spotify. So again, students can easily share the episode they made with anyone they choose. These episodes, students actually think back at their whole educational journey and think, What have I learned at Providence? What is a lesson that stands out in my mind and a lesson that I want to share with listeners? So these projects are still pretty new, but I'm teaching courses again this year. Students will be engaged in these assignments, and I'm really excited to grow our blog and grow our podcast year after year. So as I conclude, I just want to respond to this question, because maybe some of you in the audience are thinking this. I've hopefully explained why communication matters, generally speaking, but perhaps you're wondering why communication matters to those of us interested in science and faith dialogue, or ASA. So I want to go back to two of those points that I mentioned at the start of my talk. I think the fact that communication promotes learning is really meaningful to us, because not only are we interested in our students learning science, those of us that teach in the science realm, but we're also wanting our students to learn how to integrate science and faith. And if you get your students talking about this, discussing it, communicating it, then they can do that to learn, to better see how science and faith work together. The fact that communication builds trusting relationships is also really meaningful to us, because those of us at faith-based institutions know that we have students that come from some faith communities. And they may know the needs of their communities best. They may know if their neighbors and if their family members want to hear stories, or want to hear statistics, or want to hear it all. And this can help to address low scientific literacy, but it's not only in a deficient model, because so many of our communities are not illiterate. They are quite scientifically literate. They know science, at least to a certain degree. But sometimes there are negative attitudes or mistrust that can still be at least partially addressed by kind communication. And then lastly, just in case you're wondering, I did want to introduce this point. If we train them, they will go. Communication training based on research does promote participation. In a classroom environment, students can gain the confidence and the skills they need to try it out in real life. And isn't that the goal? So they will communicate in their homes, workplaces, places of worship, and I tried to show that on this schematic here. I put bi-directional arrows because, of course, we don't want one-way lectures. We want many information flowing in many directions and fruitful communications. The last thing I'll share with you here today is just a quote about one of the reasons why this matters to me personally. Science communication and just communication in general really is important, and a lot of people rely on this for making important decisions, even life or death decisions. So you see a statistic here from Navigating Trust in U.S. Society where it says 72% of respondents said their relationship with friends and family helped them to make decisions about vaccines and any other topics. So in summary, I've tried my best to highlight two communication approaches that aren't mutually exclusive. You can follow both dedicated communication courses and communication across the curriculum. And there's lots of technology that can help you do that. That's not too hard to use. And then I put in bold here, I think, some of my main take-home points. The fact that communication training increases participation, promotes learning, and at least helps to build trusting relationships. So thank you for your time. I look forward to connecting with you and answering some questions.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dahlschneider, for a really wonderful presentation. I think I speak on behalf of everyone when I say we all learned a lot.
Thank you, Rebecca. I've been on the Writing Across the Curriculum Committee at two separate colleges, and one of the discussions we're having currently at our school is the discussion that, well, if the English faculty would just teach students how to write, everything would be fine. And our English faculty, it's not from a lack of trying, but one of the discussions that has come up is that writing and communication don't look the same in all disciplines, and mm-hmm. that there are genres. And so I was wondering if you had had those types of discussions and how we help students learn that just because you communicate this way in history or in English, you mm-hmm. might communicate differently in the sciences, and there's different expectations.
That's a great question. Thanks for that. Yeah, and I've heard comments like that before. If only high school teachers could teach our, you know, better prepare our students before college or university. If only our English department was doing their job. It's quite easy to place blame and to not accept our role in that. And I have so many colleagues, actually, that say, well, I assign papers, but I don't actually teach my students how to write them. I don't even grade their writing mechanics. And that's not something I personally do. If ever I assign a paper to students, I provide them some guidance, maybe not in class, but in terms of resources within our learning management system. And I think that's a great way to help students see stylistic differences. So for sure at Providence, we've actually surveyed to see how many different reference styles our students are making use of. And in their 3 to 4 year degree, they're following at least 3 different referencing styles in an equally diverse writing styles. And so our best way, and I don't want to do away with that, that makes sense because we see that in professional jobs, we have to follow different style guides. And I think for myself, the best way to help students understand that is to, in the assignment instructions, explain everything very clearly. Not just say, here is a link to Owl Purdue so you can see how APA styling works. Actually give some samples, maybe even give them an early assignment to say, choose 2 references and submit their full citation in APA format. I don't know, there's so many little things we can do, I think, to help our students prepare for the diversity. And just one other thing, I think one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about my scientific writing and communication course is that scientific writing is a very different style than, say, history and a lot of the other academic disciplines. So I think having specialized courses is useful as well.
Thank you for that. As an administrator, I have a sort of broader overview of some of the stuff. Mm-hmm. And to answer one of your questions about why doesn't the English faculty teach our students to write, the number one transferred in class at our university is English composition. We're not teaching them. Our English faculty are not teaching them. They're sneaking in under the radar with that and not learning how to write. So that's one of our problems. My question had to do with this idea of having students post to social media and that sort of thing. Mm. Our university is very careful about what goes out associated with our branding and our name. I love the idea, but it also terrifies me because I hear some of the things that come out of students' mouths.
For sure.
How do you handle that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so that's why I make use of our Prov app for social media assignments. So I don't ask students to tweet or make a post on Facebook or Instagram or any of the other platforms. It's internal. So our Prov app is only accessed by Providence students and Providence staff and faculty. And so it's a little bit contained. I still see that there could be image issues, but the assignments are always quite short and usually, as you saw, a short little paragraph about something that student has learned. In terms of our blog and our podcast, I actually had our external relations department vet that before those went live, just because they do have the Providence name on them, well, as my affiliation. And so I think that that's a way that if you wanted to get your students' work out there, to network with external relations, with marketing, with communication, to make sure that you are doing so with their blessing and with their expertise. So.
Thank you for your response. And that's all the time we have for questions. Thank you.